Okay, I call this meeting of the Energy, Finance, and Policy Committee to order. We do have a quorum. Our first item is that we have some minutes from February 26th, 2026. Chair Swedzinski, would you like to move the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would like to move the minutes from February 26th of 2026 to be approved.
Great. We have a motion. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. First order of business is House File 3556. Chair Akam, you want to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is on, right? Yeah. So thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to present House File 3556. It's a bill that is simply renaming the Community Solar Garden Program after Melissa Hortman. And it's a small way of showing her vision and her leadership and her public impact, really. I will say that arguably Melissa Hortman was the most consequential speaker in the Minnesota House history. And one thing I think we all knew about Melissa is that she wasn't always seeking the spotlight. She wasn't looking to be recognized, and she really enjoyed the opportunity to be able to lift up others. And so she probably wouldn't be very comfortable with this today, but I think that's why it's really important. And what I also appreciate about Melissa is that she felt like one of her favorite roles here was being chair of the Energy Committee. And I think that she enjoyed getting into the meat of the subjects. And as we all know, Melissa worked really hard. She worked with all of those that were impacted, and she came with, wanting to come up with a solution. And so I love that on her Twitter handle that she defined herself as a speaker, a member of the Minnesota House, and author of the Community Solar Garden and Solar Standard. And so these were accomplishments that happened under her leadership that she really felt strongly about. I think she traveled the country and honestly the world talking about the Community Solar Garden program, and many others have modeled their programs after the program that was started here in Minnesota. Our researcher went back and got me the clips from the floor debate when they passed the Community Solar Garden Bill in 2013, and it was really fun to watch and see some familiar faces. I think that Steve Simon was presiding over the House that day, and Aaron Murphy was on the House floor, and in Melissa's comments, she referenced that session that Bob Eloff worked really, really hard. And we know that Bob works hard every session, so I'm glad that that's the way it's always been, even back in 2013. But passing the Community Solar Garden Bill was not only important to expand access to solar to so many, but it really sent a signal to the Community Solar Garden, the solar industry, I'll get it right. It really sent a signal that Minnesota was open for business, and it really started what has become a thriving solar industry in our state. And I think that's evident by so many of the members of that industry that are here today. And I don't want to go much further. I know they're going to talk a lot about the impacts on the industry, and so I will leave them to do that. And I think, Mr. Chair, there's a list of speakers, so maybe we can turn it over to our testifiers.
Yeah, thank you, Manager. Just one housekeeping item. I think we need to move the bill at this point. Would you like to do that?
Oh, that's an important piece of this, isn't it? Yeah. I would like to move House File 3556 to the General Register.
All right. Chair, you can move House File 3556 to the General Register. We will now have testifiers. First on the list is Katie Sieben. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and then proceed.
Chair Acom, Chair Swidinski, members of the committee, Chair Kraft, thank you so much for the opportunity to be here today. For the record, I'm Katie Sieben, the Chair of the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. Today, I urge your support of House File 3556 to rename the CSG program the Melissa Hortman Community Solar Garden Program, because it's a fitting tribute to Melissa Hortman's passion and dedication to a brighter, cleaner future for Minnesota. Melissa and I served together in the Minnesota House during the 2005 to 2007 sessions, but our friendship and collegiality continued over the next decade with conversations about civility, the patriarchy, our shared love of Walter Mondale, children, especially our own, unions, women's leadership in the C-suites, tribal engagement, recycling, and flowers, cementing our friendship as legislators and public servants. In the spring of 2013, as the energy omnibus legislation that contained this community solar garden program was moving through the House, I was serving as the assistant majority leader in the Senate and was a member of the Senate Energy Committee. Senator John Marty worked closely with Senator Hoffman and other senators to pass at that time nation-leading solar energy policies. I remember being so proud of the trifecta's energy policies then, including the Community Solar Garden Program in that omnibus bill. Like Chair Acom, I listened to the archived recording, but of then-Chair Hortman describing her legislation that would lead to the creation of the CSG program. I was struck, like has been stated here, again by hearing her voice. She was prepared, articulate, without being argumentative and effective at persuasion by her command of her favorite topic. Her leadership on energy, of course, didn't end when she ascended to higher positions. Becoming speaker meant changing from being an advocate to being a leader, she said in an article from the Harvard Kennedy School. In our role as legislators, we are advocates for particular policies and causes, but in the higher levels of leadership, you become an executive running an organization and directing the entire institution to be effective. And as we know, she was such an effective executive. As Speaker, Minnesota again led the nation with clean energy mandates that would not have happened without her guidance and leadership. She engaged deeply with me as the chair of the commission on issues related to energy and affordability in her role as speaker and as I've been the chair of the commission. Melissa shone brightly, and her legacy shines brightest with regard to a clean energy future. Naming the community solar program in her honor is a fitting tribute to her lifetime of service. I urge your support.
Thank you. Next, we have Pete Wyckoff. And so we're ready. Pete will be followed by Logan O'Grady. Welcome back to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thanks for being here. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Acom. And thank you, committee. My name is Pete Wyckoff. I'm Deputy Commissioner of Commerce for Energy. And I'm here today in support of the bill you lead, H.R. 3556, which will rename Minnesota's groundbreaking community solar garden program as the Melissa Hortman Community Solar Garden Program. Speaker Hortman was a tireless champion of solar energy in general and community solar gardens in particular. As chair of this committee in 2013, then Representative Hortman recognized the need to encourage a young, budding solar energy industry in Minnesota. community solar gardens, or CSGs to the hip kids, represented a way to allow Minnesotans to obtain solar energy to meet their electric needs, regardless of whether they owned a home that was appropriate for rooftop solar or not. CSGs are also a proven mechanism for building medium-sized solar installations, which have additional grid value because they are often sited much nearer load than utility-scale solar. Minnesota's community solar garden program is truly a national model and has been replicated elsewhere. A recent article documented how CSGs are continuing to spread, often led now by Republican legislators in states like Georgia, Iowa, Missouri, and Ohio. Minnesota's CSG program was the initial driver of solar build-out at scale in Minnesota. For a long time, CSGs were responsible for a large majority of Minnesota's solar deployment. Utility-scale solar is finally catching up, but CSGs still represent over 40% of Minnesota's installed solar capacity. 3 years ago, as part of a flurry of legislation designed to accelerate the transition of Minnesota's electric system to one that is more reliable, more resilient, more affordable, and more clean, the original community solar garden program was revised and recast. Speaker Hartman was again a driving force behind the legislation. Since 2023, the Energy Division at the Minnesota Department of Commerce has run the Low and Moderate Income Community Solar Garden Program. We have pushed the total cumulative approved solar gardens in Minnesota to well over 1 gigawatt. For comparison, that nameplate capacity is substantially more than the 700 megawatts of polluting coal energy that Xcel plans to retire this year. The Commerce-run CSG program has approved 134 total new projects. The revised law requires that at least 30% of the solar capacity go to low and moderate income households, resulting in at least 10% average bill savings. To date, the actual number for approved gardens has been 70% low and moderate income subscribers and 12.3% savings. So we have leaped over those requirements. So the program is exceeding statutory goals. If you add in other targeted subscribers, affordable housing, schools, nonprofits, et cetera, the total targeted subscribers are nearly 80% of the approved new capacity. Community solar gardens set the stage for the development of solar power in Minnesota and were a vital step towards ensuring that everyone, regardless of their income or where they live, has a chance to benefit from the clean energy boom. When our solar build-out is complete, CSGs will only be a small part of Minnesota's electric system, but they have been essential to catalyzing solar development in Minnesota. And we can thank Melissa Hortman for that. I encourage you to support this bill.
Thank you. Next is Logan O'Grady. Please introduce yourself and then proceed, and following that will be Nick Bowman.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Logan O'Grady. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Solar Energy Industries Association. I have the great privilege of representing our entire solar industry here in the state of Minnesota and the over 5,000 Minnesotans that work within that industry, many of whom are here today to support this legislation. I'm here with a heavy heart but immense pride in the strong support of this legislation. And thank you to Representative Acom for bringing this forward and giving our industry an opportunity to show our deep love for Speaker Emerita Hortman. I've often testified before this body that our industry is a creature of statute. Unlike a lot of other industries where policies and regulations are reactionary and created after the industry has developed, our industry was fundamentally created by the laws passed in these very rooms. We were born out of policy, guided by a perspective of regulations from day one, and our daily work is dictated by the decisions that you all make in this chamber. Because of that reality, it is difficult, and sometimes we're unable to point to people and say they are the reason that this entire industry exists. But for us, that person is Melissa. She's a hero to our community. Over the years, we had had many names for her. She was, of course, representative and speaker, but in our world, she was our champion, our fiercest ally, our defender, our five-star general, and most affectionately, however, she was our solar godmother. She's the reason thousands of people across Minnesota have a job and a livelihood today. For the solar community, this bill isn't just about policy, it's deeply personal. In 2023, we tried to show her a fraction of our gratitude by presenting her with our industry's Lifetime Achievement Award, an honor that now proudly bears her name. Looking back, I can't express how grateful I am that we gave her that award when we had the chance. It stands as another enduring lesson she left for us. Don't hesitate, don't wait, do the work now, and express your gratitude now. When we handed her that award, her response was, "Here, Melissa." She gave me a hard time, joking, "What am I supposed to do, retire now?" But quickly assured me that she still had a lot of work to do. She had a staggering list of accomplishments over her incredible career, yet to this day, as Chair Akam mentioned, her bio states only one, author of Minnesota's Solar Standard and Community Solar Law. Knowing how fiercely she cherished that work gives us all an incredible amount of comfort. Our industry is still young enough that I often say we are building the plane as we're flying it. Melissa was our first captain. She lifted us off the ground, and we are heartbroken to be no longer flying with her. But her flight path went far beyond the borders of Minnesota. Because of her relentless vision, dozens of states are now following her lead in community solar and doing so in a bipartisan way, just as Melissa would have wanted it. One of my final conversations with her happened in the waning days of the 2025 session. We were, as usual, deep in the trenches of a heavy legislative fight over the CSG program. I asked her why, after years of relentless battle, she fought so passionately for it. She didn't blink. She said the program was put into place to deploy as much solar as possible, as fast as possible, since our planet is literally on fire. An editor's note, I may have taken out a swear word within that conversation. But behind that fierce, unapologetic determination was a profound humanity that defined her entire approach to politics and policymaking. Melissa understood that while the stakes are high for our climate, the work was always about the people. She had a rare, beautiful ability to look past the political rhetoric and genuinely connect. And that's my personal takeaway from her life and my commitment to those of you in this room that we work with on a lot of legislation, to see you all behind the party labels or the job titles and aggressively seek common ground where we can find it. The solar industry has been unjustifiably politicized over the years. We can and must try to correct that by modeling the exact humanity that Melissa has taught us. She never stopped fighting for Minnesota, and she never stopped fighting for our planet. Renaming the program after her is the least we can do to acknowledge her real impact on our industry. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Nick Bowman. Please introduce yourself and proceed. Following Nick, we'll have George Damian.
Thank you, Chair Kraft, Chair Swazinski, and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Nick Bowman, and I serve as the Senior Manager of Markets and Research for the Coalition for Community Solar Access, or CCSA. It is my privilege to speak in strong support of HF 3556 today. CCSA is a national trade association representing more than 120 community solar developers, businesses, and nonprofit organizations working to expand access to affordable, locally generated solar energy for American households and businesses. Minnesota holds a special place in the history of community solar. Speaker Hortman was the original legislative champion who authored and advanced the language, creating Minnesota's community solar program as part of the 2013 Energy Omnibus Bill. Her leadership, foresight, and persistence were instrumental in establishing what would become one of the most successful community solar programs in the nation. Without her work, Minnesota would not be the national leader it is today in expanding customer choice and access to clean energy. At the time, Minnesota's program was one of the first in the nation. It helped prove that third-party community solar could work at scale, delivering savings to families, new options for small businesses, local economic development, and meaningful carbon reductions. Because of that early leadership, other states followed. Today, more than a dozen states operate third-party community solar programs, collectively generating more than 10 gigawatts of community solar capacity nationwide. Here in Minnesota alone, more than 1 gigawatt of community solar is now delivering clean, locally produced energy to residents and businesses. That represents thousands of subscribers, millions of dollars in private investment, and a durable clean energy market that continues to create jobs and expand access to those who cannot install solar on their own roofs. CCSA is proud to support HF 3556, renaming Minnesota's community solar program in Speaker Hortman's honor, would appropriately recognize her foundational role in creating this market and would permanently link her legacy to one of the state's most impactful clean energy achievements. It would also send a clear message that Minnesota values pragmatic, forward-looking leadership that expands opportunity and delivers tangible results for its residents. I can think of no more fitting tribute than to attach her name to a program that has empowered Minnesotans, strengthened local economies, and positioned the state as a national clean energy leader. Thank you for your time and consideration, and I respectfully urge your support of HF 3556.
Thank you. Next is George Damian. George, please introduce yourself and proceed. Following George is Bobby King.
Thank you, Vice Chair Kraft and committee members. My name is George Damian, and I'm the Director of Government Affairs for Clean Energy Economy Minnesota, also known as SEEM. We are an industry-led, nonpartisan nonprofit representing more than 70 clean energy businesses who employ tens of thousands of Minnesotans across the state. Speaker Melissa Hortman was a larger-than-life figure in the Minnesota House. She was not only a champion of renewable energy, she was a steward of the institution itself. She understood the weight of the decisions made in this room and approached energy policy with a seriousness, discipline, and long-term perspective. She believed Minnesota could lead on renewable energy while strengthening our economy and creating durable public policy that businesses and communities could rely on. What set her apart was her credibility across party lines. Even in moments of disagreement, she earned the respect for her preparation, her integrity, and her commitment to getting policy right. She was focused not on headlines, but on building frameworks that would stand the test of time. Today, Minnesota's clean energy economy supports over 60,000 jobs and attracts national investment. That trajectory did not happen by accident. It reflects leaders like Speaker Hortman, who will win to think big and build lasting foundations. Honoring Speaker Hortman in this way is a fitting tribute to a leader who shaped Minnesota's energy future and strengthened the house she served. SEEM thanks Chair Akin for bringing this bill forward and urges your support.
Thank you. Next is Bobby King. Please introduce yourself and then proceed. Following Bobby, we'll have Patty O'Keefe.
Chair and committee, my name is Bobby King. I'm the Minnesota State Director for Solar United Neighbors. We help folks access solar at their homes, farms, and small businesses and work for policy that makes more solar possible, and I'm testifying in support of this legislation. It took vision, expertise, determination, and political savvy to establish Minnesota's community solar garden program. Melissa Hortman had this unique set of skills, was strong in actually every one of those categories, and we're fortunate that she put that to work to establish this nation-leading program. The program, as others have testified to, delivers energy savings and value to all XL ratepayers. It has created a lot of jobs to build the community solar, maintain it, and manage the subscriptions. And it delivers renewable energy that we need to address climate change. Representative Hortman wanted Minnesota to be a North Star on modeling how we can move to a renewable energy system in a way that benefits us all. The Community Solar Garden Program does that. It wouldn't be here without her, and it's fitting that the program bear her name. Thank you.
Thank you. Next is Patty O'Keefe. Following Patty will be Timothy Denherter Thomas. All right. Welcome back to the committee. Please state your name for the record, then proceed.
Hi, everybody. My name is Patty O'Keefe. I am with Vote Solar. Just want to share our support, my support for House File 3556. my first time testifying on any bill at the legislature was on a solar tax credit bill that came before the House Energy Committee. It was back when Pat Garofalo was the chair of the committee, and I testified and I shared about how my mom really wanted to. She wanted to get solar panels on her roof, but at the time she couldn't afford it. She didn't have great credit, and so we were, wanting more solutions for people that really wanted to go solar but maybe couldn't for certain reasons. And Melissa Hortman was on the committee at that time, and she came up to me after that hearing and just thanked me for sharing about my mom, told me that, vulnerability can be, it's hard and important. And she encouraged me to just go on and keep pushing. And it was the first conversation that I'd had with her, and I was, she motivated me. And now, I work at Vote Solar. I'm still pushing. She was an incredible person, and I miss her. And I just want to say that. And what other people have said is true. The reason that we have a successful community solar program today is because of Melissa Hortman. She was passionate about all solar, but especially community solar, because it was more directly connected to people, and she deeply cared about people. And I think this name change, it gives credit where it's due, but also ensures that people know and remember her impact on that issue, long after we're no longer sitting in these chairs and it's other people, right? So just want to say thank you for considering the bill, and thank you.
Thank you. After Timothy, we're going to have Eric Pazzi. Please introduce yourself, Timothy, and proceed.
Thank you. My name is Timothy Denner-Thomas. I'm general manager at Cooperative Energy Futures, and I'm speaking in support of House File 3556. Cooperative Energy Futures is a member-owned co-op. We have about 1,500 member owners across Minnesota, ranging from North Minneapolis to St. Cloud and Faribault and all parts of central and southern Minnesota. And we believe, as we know Speaker Melissa Hortman did, that we need an energy future where all Minnesotans can participate, and can benefit from the clean energy transition. That this is, not just for big companies, for Wall Street, for utilities. This is also for folks like me and you. And that's really what our cooperative has been about. We've been building an organization really fueled by the community solar program that is helping low and moderate income households reduce their energy bills really participate, build wealth from helping enable community solar and solar energy development in our state. We've really seen this program be a game changer in terms of access, enabling renters, enabling folks who can't put solar on their own roof, and also as a very easy way for people to get into other parts of the energy transition, into energy efficiency and electrification and all those sorts of things. And throughout, Melissa Hortman has been an incredible champion in the original foundation and passage of this program. And in the overhaul in 2023 that reshaped it to much more strongly focus on low and moderate income households. This program is a really key element of Speaker Hortman's legacy. And while I would much rather be celebrating the progress of this program with her here with us, I can think of really no better way to honor her contributions to an energy future in Minnesota that really is designed to work for all of us, to be for Minnesotans, and to show what a different type of energy future can look like. Thank you.
Thank you. After Eric, we're going to have Erica Forsman. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Chair and members. My name is Eric Posse. I'm the CEO of Enterprise Energy, a Minnesota-based community solar developer, and I'm here in strong support of naming this program in honor of Melissa Hortman. In 2013, Minnesota made history with the Solar Jobs Act, creating the first significant community solar program in the country. That didn't happen by accident. It happened because of leadership. Melissa was central to that effort. Because of this program, companies like Enterprise Energy were able to form, grow, and serve communities across our state. Thousands of Minnesotans, renters, small businesses, schools, and especially low and moderate income families have been able to participate in clean energy for the first time. This program didn't just build solar farms, it built Minnesota businesses, it built careers, it built opportunity. And when the program needed to evolve, she stepped up again in 2023, helping refocus it to better serve families who might otherwise be left behind, while also leading Minnesota toward 100% clean energy by 2040. But what I'll remember most is personal. When I was new to the process in 2013, no title, no influence, she took a meeting. She listened. She treated me as if I mattered. That combination of courage and kindness is rare. Renaming this program isn't symbolic, it's fitting. Because every time Enterprise Energy brings a new solar project online, every time a Minnesota family saves money through community solar, her impact is still working. The Minnesota Community Solar Program changed my life and built Enterprise Energy. Naming it after Melissa Hortman simply tells the truth about who made that possible. Thank you.
Thank you. Next is Erica Forsman, and Erica will be followed by Jim Pearson. Welcome. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Vice Chair Kraft, Chair Swedinsky, committee members, thank you. My name is Erica Forsman, and I serve as the Chief Commercial Officer for U.S. Solar. We're a Minnesota-based, full-scale solar and battery energy storage developer and owner-operator. We have been active in Minnesota's community solar program since our founding in 2014. If you ask U.S. Solar about Melissa Hortman, we view her as the singular leader who made the community solar program possible. Quite simply, without her leadership, this market would not exist the way it does today. If you ask other organizations, you will hear about her impact in many different areas, making life more affordable for families, strengthening early childhood education, and improving access to affordable health care for all. Regardless of who you ask and which policy area they care most about, you will constantly hear the same thing. Melissa Hortman was one of the most effective legislators in Minnesota. What truly set her apart was not just the policies she advanced, but how she led, with discipline, strategic clarity, and the ability to build bipartisan relationships that delivered real results for Minnesota. As energy chair, she authored the landmark community solar legislation in 2013 that sparked the solar sector growth across the state. The policy framework she created enabled companies like ours to get our start and grow while investing in skilled employees here in Minnesota. Since the passage of the bill in 2013, U.S. Solar has employed over 50 local professionals and provided hundreds of jobs to our community of construction contractors and engineers. We've created broad benefits, including rural economic development, improved grid resilience, and delivered valuable savings to thousands of residents, public entities, and local businesses. Because of Minnesota's early adoption of the Community Solar Program, Minnesota-based companies were able to gain experience and capabilities early. Some other markets are dominated by out-of-state companies, but this early experience put Minnesota-based companies in a position to lead their home market and set an example for other states. Today, U.S. Solar is a medium-scale business that embraces new technologies like battery energy storage systems and competes against and often wins against larger international companies. We were lucky to get our start in Minnesota and in this program. I have worked in solar in the state of Minnesota since 2009, As a former board member and president of Mincia, I have seen firsthand the transformation that the passage of the community solar legislation in 2013 and the broader impact that that brought to the industry. By positioning Minnesota as a national leader in community solar, the state created a proving ground for larger projects, attracted new financing partners, and built expertise that allowed companies across the sector to grow. The workforce growth extended beyond developers. It included construction and engineering, legal and finance, real estate, and many more sectors. Her work created the market certainty and the structure that allowed businesses to invest, hire, and scale here in Minnesota. One invaluable lesson Melissa Hortman taught me personally, and a lot of leaders in Minnesota renewable energy, is to never waver in the face of immense pressure. It took years and relentless effort, but Melissa and others ultimately succeeded to reshape the program to prioritize low to moderate income subscribers. And now thousands of income qualified households will have a lower energy burden thanks to this revised community solar program. In closing, Melissa Hortman was a champion for our company, for community solar, the solar industry, and the future of Minnesota. Minnesota leads because Melissa Hortman believed that we should. U.S. Solar supports this bill to officially rename the Community Solar Program in honor of Melissa Hortman. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Pearson, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, committee. Jim Pearson with Xcel Energy. I'll be brief. You've heard a lot of great and powerful testimony, and I don't need to belabor that, but I did want to lend our support to Representative Akam and the bill. I was part of the Xcel team in 2013 when the bill was negotiated, and I've been around the discussion ever since, and I can absolutely say there was no bigger champion of the program than Melissa Hortman. So bringing the bill forward and giving her the recognition and the credit for the program, we fully support, and it's I just appreciate being able to lend our voice to today's conversation. So thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you. Is there anyone else from the public that would like to testify? Okay, with that, we'll move to member comments. Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Vice Chair, and thank you, Chair Akam, for bringing this bill forward. I can't help but think that Melissa would say, as she said when she saw the plans for the remodeled or the redo of the state office building, it's a bit much. However, that said, it's more than fitting, more than due, and thank you for doing it. I think somehow she'll get by.
Yeah.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chair Akam, for bringing the bill. It's very reflective. I came in here my first term when Representative Hortman at the time was not the chair any longer when Pat Garofalo became chair, but she was on the Energy Committee with me, and she kicked my butt. I was not a fan of community solar gardens because it was really expensive at the time, getting things off and running. I was really challenging it a lot, and she really taught me how to be a better legislator, about how to learn and understand the bills. She was so smart. She was just... And again, when she got behind something, nothing got in her way, whether she was a representative or a speaker. I appreciated what Chair Seaman had to say about Melissa, and I was hoping when she mentioned this that there was that video cut of her, and we should have been playing that today.
Yeah.
And maybe another time, but and I didn't see it, and so it was before my time when she was the chair, kind of wrapping this thing up. But she was so good at what she did and what she believed in. And again, we may not have agreed on how it was done, but she certainly changed the way Minnesota looked at solar. And again, with my work on the net metering bill right now, with you and Representative Kraft and our Mencia folks and the co-ops and others, I believe that she would want to make sure that we got this right if we are going to find compromise somewhere. But Melissa was such a champion around energy and how she wanted to do it. So I think this is a very good bill to support. Thank you.
Thanks. Representative Mahmoud.
Thank you so much for bringing this forward. Speaker Hortman was a powerhouse, and so I find this very fitting in a way to remember and honor her. And, you know, just having worked with everyone here, I just know the appreciation that we all have for her leadership. I only got to work with her for a year, and in that year, I got to see the impact that she had on all of us. And so thank you so much for bringing this forward. I really see this as so fitting.
Chair Swedzinski.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Aiken, for carrying this bill. I think we would all wish, every single person in this room would wish a bill like this doesn't exist, right? And, I think the heartfelt debate on CSG as a whole, this is not what we're debating today. We're debating on the quality of a legislator, a quality of a person, a quality of a woman, and the importance of taking leadership in things that you believe. Whether you agree with them or not, that this is one thing that is not up for debate, is the quality of Melissa Hortman as a person, as a legislator, and as a woman. And so we want to thank Melissa Hortman for her work, and we want to thank you, Madam Chair, for carrying this bill, and I would just recommend everyone can vote yes today. So thank you.
I'll have a few comments before I send it back to you. Representative Baker, I think there are many people that could say Melissa Hortman kicked my butt. She had an impact in so many areas. You hear about the lives, the jobs, the economic impact, the impact on clean energy that's in this area, and that impact is in spades in so many other areas. We miss her every day. I miss her every day. You know, we're getting through this, and we'll be fine because of the great team she built, but it's hard, and the emotion is never that far beneath the surface. And then the last thing is that, Logan, you mentioned that she said she had a lot of work to do, and I think it's to us to continue that work. Thank you. Madam Chair.
Well, I want to start by thanking everybody who came today and who testified for the stories that you shared. And this path of grief that we're on together, I also miss her terribly. Melissa should still be here. Her service to our state wasn't done. Renaming the Community Solar Garden program in her name is one way we can make sure she's not forgotten. I renew my motion that House File 3556 be referred to the General Register.
Chair Aiken renews her motion that House File 3556 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The bill is referred to the General Register. Give us a minute here as we swap chairs.
Thank goodness for an agenda that is printed and ready. next, we're going to have a wonderful presentation from MPCA. So we have Kate Knuth, the climate director, and Frank Kolash. And so please go ahead, introduce yourself, and proceed if you're able.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Chair Swedinski. Very, very solemn opportunity to present on this, but hopefully this fits in into a category of the work goes on, and that's what we'll be talking about today for climate action in Minnesota. For the record, my name is Frank Kolash. I'm Assistant Commissioner for Air and Climate Policy for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And thank you for the opportunity to present today. Before Climate Director Knuth provides the presentation on greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota and the 2026 Climate Action Framework, I want to emphasize that while the MPCA is presenting today, we accomplished this work through strong collaboration with the Climate Change Subcabinet and the Governor's Advisory Council on Climate Change. As you will see in the presentation, the Climate Change Subcabinet is made up of 17 state agencies, departments, boards, and councils. Each member of the Climate Change Subcabinet brings their deep knowledge and expertise to our climate work, especially the Climate Action Framework. Without contributions from the Departments of Commerce, Transportation, Agriculture, Natural Resources, Health, Labor and Industry, Employment and Economic Development, Administration, and the Climate Innovation Finance Authority and the Board of Water and Soil Resources and the Minnesota Management and Budget, we could not have developed such a comprehensive framework for Minnesota. The MPCA is proud to present on behalf of the Climate Change Subcabinet on this important work to ensure Minnesota reduces our emissions that are contributing to climate change, prepares Minnesotans for the changing climate that we are already experiencing and will experience in the near future, ensure that all Minnesotans are receiving the benefit of climate action and growing a clean economy for all Minnesotans. With that, I will hand the microphone over to Climate Director Knuth.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Assistant Commissioner Kolash. Deep breath, that was a testimony prep that I was not 100% prepared for, but am very grateful for the many others who had the wonderful experience of knowing and serving with and being made better by the relationship with Melissa Hortman. I'm gonna channel the wonder of that into this presentation. So I'll be talking today about the, and I did say my name for the record, didn't I? Okay, thank you, sorry. Kate Knuth, Climate Director at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency for the record. I'll be presenting today about newly released updated greenhouse gas inventory data as well as the newly updated Minnesota Climate Action Framework. I will note that after being asked for several years, MPCA has released greenhouse gas inventory data in between our two statutorily required reports. So the data that we'll talk about today covers through 2023, and high-level take-home, you can see it on this slide. Between 2005 and 2023, Minnesota has seen about a 20% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions and roughly 2 percentage points between 2022 and 2023. So roughly 146 million metric tons to 117 million metric tons. As you all know, Minnesota has statutory goals of a 30% reduction by 2025, 50% by 2030, and carbon neutrality by 2050, and these goals are represented by the green line in the chart. Just to give you a sense of where the emissions are coming from by sector, transportation is the largest source of emissions, followed by agriculture and electricity generation. Public policy does make a difference. Our electricity generation used to actually be the largest, so we're seeing that reduction, and I'll go into the details of the different sectors. Starting with transportation and agriculture, the two largest, transportation has seen a reduction of 9% between 2005 and 2023. The largest sources within this category are light-duty trucks as well as heavy-duty trucks, so vehicles that we use to move ourselves and various things. Agriculture has seen about a 1% increase, and the largest sources within that category are fertilizer, nitrous oxide, as well as animal agriculture. On the energy and industry side, electricity generation is a huge success story. We see a 50% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions from 2005 to 2023. And the largest sources there continue to be coal and natural gas. And as you all know, with the passage of 100% clean energy, there is a plan to get that sector to net zero emissions. The industrial sector has seen an increase of 9%. The largest sources here are oil and natural gas, notably basically burning of fossil fuels for various heat reasons. And just to be clear, electricity that's used within industry or in our homes is counted within the electricity sector, just for that clarity around the inventory. The commercial sector and the residential sector, so these are roughly buildings together. These two make up all of our buildings. Commercial buildings have seen a 15% increase in greenhouse gas emissions, while residential buildings have seen a 22% increase in greenhouse gas emissions. Again, burning of natural gas or heating oil, as well as air conditioning and refrigeration, particularly in commercial buildings. Land use change in forestry. So this, for the first time in the previous inventory that we released about a year ago, we separated out agriculture and land use change in forestry, just because there's pretty significant differences between them, and it helps make the data more clear for good public policy making. We've seen a 25% decrease in emissions in this sector. So this actually offsets 8.4% of our emissions in the state overall. The largest carbon sinks where carbon is stored is in existing forests and their growth, as well as converting land that used to be forests back to forests. So that's a quick overview of the inventory. And I'm not sure, Chair Ikum, if you'd like me to go straight into the framework or if there's any clarifying questions. I want to make sure we have stuff for the framework, so it's up to you.
Why don't you go ahead and we'll save questions till the end.
Okay, perfect.
Great.
For the 2026 Climate Action Framework, I will note one thing here just about the data. If you do look in the inventory, this still uses the 2022 greenhouse gas inventory. If you have eagle eyes looking at the specifics, just want to make that clear to you as we go through. I don't think it's on any of the slides I'll be presenting, but if you dive into the documents. Over the last approximately 18 months, Minnesota has updated our state's climate action framework. The state published the climate action framework originally in September of 2022, and this we went through a process across the sub-cabinet agencies, as Assistant Commissioner Kolash described, and worked really closely with Minnesotans and with the Governor's Advisory Committee on Climate Change Advisory Committee. So the plan is to help us tackle our climate crisis by cutting pollution, protecting our communities from extreme weather, and making sure we're building a strong, forward-looking economy. Just to give you a picture of all the many people, evoke the many people who contributed to this framework, this is a picture from our release. Just a couple weeks ago, on February 11th, is when we released this framework publicly, and you'll see sub-cabinet commissioners, organizational leads, advisory council members in that picture. And again, here listing the various agencies that were involved and staff from those agencies, as well as the 15 members of the Advisory Council on Climate Change and hundreds of Minnesotans who gave us feedback through three rounds of public engagement with documents we published and got feedback from Minnesotans on. Overall, take-home message, our vision stands. It's a three-part vision of carbon neutrality, resilience, and equity. And we really try to emphasize that each pillar of this vision is essential to create the future the Climate Action Framework envisions. We want our state to be carbon neutral by 2050, aligned with the statutory goals. We want to make sure that all Minnesotans are resilient in the face of climate change, the changes we're experiencing today, and those that we know are coming. So investing in preparing communities with climate smart infrastructure and other preparedness programs. We know these impacts are going to impact some communities more than others, and that's why we want climate action to be equitable, so all communities who are vulnerable and marginalized are able to thrive through the impacts of climate change and get a fair distribution of the benefits of climate action through programs like the Community Solar Garden Program. Every Minnesotan will play a role in this work if we're going to achieve our vision, and that kind of partnership, I think you'll notice throughout the presentation. Since the 2022 framework was adopted or released by the climate change subcabinet. There's been a lot of great work that's happened. Much of it is thanks to many in this room and both legislative leaders and community leaders and businesses. So we have 100% carbon-free electricity that became state law in 2023, $100 million investment in climate resilient community infrastructure grants that went over to over 150 communities all across the state, incentives for electric vehicle buyers, support for farmers to adopt climate-smart agriculture practices, expanding solar energy for schools as well as other public buildings, and conserving and managing our forests, grasslands, and wetlands. So what's new in the 2026 framework? We did have some capacity supported by the federal government to go deeper in some specific areas. And so highlighting what's new, there are seven goal chapters now. We teased apart one, so instead of six, we now have seven. We were able to do greenhouse gas forecasting, so using modeling to get a better sense of what kinds of policies will help us get closer to our goals. And that modeling also enabled us to do more quantified health and economic benefits analysis based on that greenhouse gas modeling, as well as more qualitative analysis too. We did deeper engagement with local government leaders, having a series of conversations over several months, and have a specific supplementary document on the essential role of local government to achieve the framework, and then a stronger tribal perspective with both a standalone chapter as well as tribal perspectives woven throughout the different goal chapters. And we did significant engagement and significant collaborative work with tribal leaders and staff. A section called The Big Things Now kind of helps focus on what are some things we really need to focus on in the near term in order to make that longer term vision our reality, knowing that it's years of work playing out over time to make climate action happen in the way we envision, and then further developing metrics and targets, so helping ourselves better understand where we're trying to go and how do we measure whether we're actually getting there. So I'm going to go into some of those new parts. The big things now, these are six near-term priorities to help achieve our long-term vision. And it really recognizes that one of the challenges of climate action is, like, what do we focus on now to, like, lay the foundation and make bigger progress towards those decades away, although 25 years doesn't seem as far as it used to, now looking out to 2050. And as we thought through these near-term priorities with the sub-cabinet leaders, we asked questions like, what do we learn from our greenhouse gas emissions forecasting? How do we focus on affordability, making sure Minnesotans can afford their lives, their energy, and are prepared for disasters and able to respond to costly disasters, and then trying to step up where the federal government has stepped back in key ways? So number one is to keep pushing on 100% clean electricity or carbon-free electricity by 2040. We know it's state law. It's also so important. It's worth reiterating that keeping it state law and implementing it effectively is really essential. The second is accelerating EV adoption and reducing transportation emissions with some of the regulatory rollbacks and rollback under the Clean Air Act, as well as elimination of the EV tax credits at the federal level. More state leadership on EV adoption will be even more important. Sustained funding for resilient infrastructure and disaster response. This is something we've heard from community leaders all across the state, the need to have funding to rely on to build resilience and preparedness within their communities. And again, a place we're seeing shifts in the federal landscape around the Federal Emergency Management Agency and preparedness and response and recovery funds from the federal government. Accelerating clean heat in buildings and industries is recognizing that these are areas we are seeing emissions increases and have seen emissions increases over the last, or since 2005, essentially for the burning of natural gas and other fossil fuels within buildings and industry. So we need to focus on making clean heat happen. And then reducing emissions in the agricultural sector, restoring peatlands and growing forests, recognizing that as climate change happens, it impacts our ecosystems. And in order to make sure that our ecosystems remain and hopefully continue to even grow as places that store carbon, we really need to double down on keeping those ecosystems healthy, whether it's in our agricultural systems, our forests, peatlands, grasslands. And then finally, strong financing strategies for the clean energy transition, recognizing that as a lot of the federal incentives have pulled back, we want to make sure all Minnesotans can participate in the transition to cleaner, healthier fuels. And so figuring out not just funding, but actual financing of these strategies, which is combined with funding to accelerate the adoption of these technologies. Recognizing the equity pillar of our vision, the climate change, or the framework throughout, and in some particular parts of the framework, we recognize that overburdened communities, often including Black people, Indigenous people, people of color, and people with lower incomes, do face greater risks from climate change-related harms. People in some phases of life also have more vulnerability, like elderly people or pregnant people, and geography can also affect climate vulnerability. For example, rural areas with less access to health care are more at risk from climate health impacts like extreme heat. So really important steps to address climate inequity involve empowering communities and climate action and working to distribute funds and resources equitably, and then working to integrate climate resilience and health equity into decision-making processes that just happen over time. Moving now to the greenhouse gas forecasting. So this is one graph that represents hours and months of work and a 100-page supplementary document. But essentially, we worked through with the sub-cabinet staff and leadership to develop three scenarios. And the names kind of say what they are. The current policy scenario is essentially a representation of our set of current policies, state and federal, and how close we would get to the emissions reductions goals in state law. The net zero scenario essentially forces the model to get to net zero, but doesn't really tell you the kind of policies to make that happen. It more tells you the most cost-effective way to do that. And then the potential policy pathways is kind of a bottom-up develop pathway with a suite of potential policies that the state could adopt or investments the state could make. It doesn't say this is necessarily what the sub-cabinet agencies support, but it is an effort to help us better understand how big and how fast we would need to go to get closer to our emissions reductions goals. It's a new part of the framework. We used a dynamic economic, demographic, and climate model to explore these three scenarios. To help us just get a better sense of where we are and how close we are to being on track. So you'll see current policy scenario, we are would be forecast to achieve 39% emissions reductions by 2050. With the potential policies pathway scenario, it gets to a 77% reduction. So to me, that means there are things we can do to get closer to our goal. A key takeaway from this is we need to move faster in order to achieve our statutory goals. And I'll talk a little bit more about this in a bit, but Minnesotans will be healthier and the economy will grow about as fast. So some of those key takeaways. Increase pace and scale of climate action to reduce greenhouse gas emissions is necessary to achieve our statutory greenhouse gas targets. A conservative estimate of the health benefits, so really just looking at the air quality improvement benefits, is a 1.17 to 2.28 billion in total health benefits. So again, it's a big number, but it's a smaller, it's a conservative estimate of the total health benefits. And then we did also model before and after changes in the federal policy landscape over the last year, both on the investments through the Inflation Reduction Act and Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act that were pulled back, as well as changes in the regulatory, in the rules under the Clean Air Act. So we do have that information, and it's basically going to be harder and more expensive to achieve our greenhouse gas emissions reduction goals. Importantly, actions to build resilience save money. Save Minnesotans money. Shade trees can reduce an air conditioning bill by nearly 25%. They're also just more comfortable. They absorb climate pollution. And every dollar spent on climate resilience saves $8 to $10 in future disaster response costs. So a real beneficial investment. As we look at the essential role of local government, there's a supplementary document focused on this, and one of my favorite maps in the climate action framework, because it shows climate action being taken all across the state in collaboration with and with support by the state government. So we have the Commerce Solar on Public Building grants, the MPCA Climate Resilient Communities Grants, and the Board of Water and Soil Resources Water Storage Grants, all of which advance important carbon neutrality, resilience, or equity, or actually probably a mix of all of them, in collaboration with local governments. And I will note that there are more dots on the map now, but as contracts get signed, they just continue to grow. The tribal coordination in support of the 2026 framework was a really robust effort that we hired a tribal state coordinator and had a tribal coordination team working across agencies that convened tribal leaders, staff, and community members across tribes that share the geography with Minnesota. We have a standalone chapter focused on tribal perspectives in the framework, as well as call-out boxes in each chapter and priority actions that are identified in our action steps document. The framework goals help organize a good chunk of the climate action framework. There is a goal chapter for each of these: clean transportation, climate smart natural and working lands, resilient communities, clean energy, healthy lives and communities, clean economy, and efficient and resilient buildings. And the kind of foundational work underneath each of these was completed by engaging sub-cabinet agency staff and community members with particular expertise in these areas. So each goal chapter, I'm kind of orienting you to the overall document because it is a 100-page plus document, but each goal chapter takes the same structure. It gives a background of the challenges and opportunities. If relevant, there's a chart of the greenhouse gas emissions and sequestration in that particular goal area. There's context relating to the three parts of the vision of the climate action framework, and there's high-level description of the actions. The several hundred action steps are in a supplementary document as well. Tribal perspectives is a standalone chapter, and then a piece of each chapter, as well as I missed targets, but each chapter includes targets to get closer to our goals within that chapter. And then how individuals, businesses, and governments can take action, recognizing, again, this is a plan that will only be achieved with many people contributing. And then finally, based on feedback we heard from our advisory council as well as Minnesotans, there was more interest in seeing tangible examples of climate action. So each goal chapter has a climate leadership story. An example of some of those climate leadership stories, so Minnesotans can see themselves and their fellow Minnesotans represented in the framework. Leanne Littlewolf is the executive director of the American Indian Community Housing Organization based out of Duluth, and their organization is working at the intersection of public health, housing, and climate change to ensure more resilient communities on the North Shore. Mike Young is a farmer in Waverly, Minnesota, and over the last 20 years, he's adopted a no-till approach to farming that has improved soil health on his farm and reduced emissions from his land. Andrew Jones is a co-founder of the company Carba, an Eden Prairie-based technology company that gets biomass compost and addresses a high emitter of greenhouse gas emissions by turning it into a solid carbon that can then be buried into and ensure long-term carbon sequestration. So achieving the vision of the framework will take these folks and many more leading in their lives and communities over many, many years. Going into each of the goal areas a little bit deeper, just quickly to talk through the goal areas, clean transportation has a vision of connecting and serving all people through a safe, equitable, and sustainable transportation system with encouraging more travel options, clean and efficient vehicles, and resilient and low carbon infrastructure and system management. Climate Smart Natural and Working Lands brings together all of the lands agencies and the different kinds of lands in the state of Minnesota, and we want to manage landscapes to absorb and store more carbon, reduce emissions, and sustain healthy and resilient lands and waters. So building up carbon sequestration and storage in forested lands, grasslands, and wetlands, building resilient ecosystems and landscapes, focusing on healthy farmland, sustainable landscapes and water management, and enhanced investments in emerging crops, products, and local economies. Resilient communities is, as the name says, making sure that all communities are prepared for and can respond to and recover from present and future climate impacts, including extreme weather. So investing in climate smart communities, healthy community green spaces and water resources, and resilient infrastructure. Clean energy This goal was split out from Goal 7, which I will talk about, but this one is really focused specifically on implementing the 100% carbon-free electricity by 2040 law to set a course for long-term sustainable use of clean energy in the state. So the enhanced grid and resilient grid infrastructure, clean energy sources, as well as dispatchable clean energy and storage. Healthy lives and communities is one of the chapters that we've seen, or that we see some of the most significant updates. This is mostly led by our Department of Health colleagues, and they were quite busy leading up to 2022. And so they had more capacity and I think really offered strong leadership to advance this chapter of the framework. So this chapter is focused on protecting health and advancing equity in a changing climate. So high-level focus areas are cooler, safer communities, protection from poor air quality, safe water, community care, climate-smart public health, and advancing equity, resilience, and justice. Clean economy is another chapter where we saw some pretty significant updates, and it's focused on building a thriving carbon-neutral economy that produces goods and services with environmental benefits and equitably provides family-sustaining job opportunities. So clean, sustainable, and resilient industrial businesses, so there's a stronger focus on the industrial sector in this framework, clean fuel and clean technology innovation, strong circular economy and resilient and equitable clean economy workforce to make sure we actually have the people to build this future. And finally, efficient and resilient buildings is a new goal area, so it's one of the more significant structural changes to the framework, and it focuses on building and maintaining healthy, comfortable, safe, efficient, and resilient buildings and homes that cost less to operate, pollute very little, and support grid stability. So decarbonize residential and commercial buildings, resilient residential and commercial buildings, and reuse of buildings and building materials. So I would encourage you to learn more. There is a lot of resources and information for you to dig into. And so I just wanted to highlight, in addition to the framework itself, we have a set of action steps. The targets are pulled out into their own supplementary document in addition to being included in the framework. There's a description of the engagement we did as part of updating the framework, a local government supplementary document, the forecasting technical support document, which has a lot of more information and research to learn from there, and then a glossary in case you need any help or a better understanding of the words we're using. So happy to answer questions.
Madam Chair, if I may, I also want to call out one additional collaborator that I forgot to mention on our long list, but the Minnesota Housing Finance Authority was also a major contributor, particularly in the buildings chapter, but throughout the entirety of the development of the climate action framework. I want to make sure they're appreciated.
Well, I certainly, you guys have been busy, so that's a lot. And before I pass it off to some questions, I have a question for you. And you early on talked about the modeling that you've been doing. And my question is that modeling available to lawmakers? Like, given that there's, I'm sure, different levers that can be, yes, you know, for policy issues.
So
go ahead, Ms. Smith.
Madam Chair, sorry.
Yeah, no, you're
Madam
good.
Chair, there is a 100-page technical support, like the forecasting document, if you want to go into the details. We did try to roll up the kind of key takeaways from that, knowing that maybe not everyone wants to go quite that deep. And so there's that document, and I know folks from my team would be happy to meet with legislators if you have specific questions about that. But I would point you to that first and then see what kind of questions or other things you might want to pull out of that.
That's great. And yeah, so it's kind of a snapshot. It's not like it. I mean, I've seen and heard about some tools that are kind of like a dashboard. If you do this, then it'll impact. Yeah. So, but it's more of a snapshot kind of thing. Go ahead, Ms. Kuhn.
Madam Chair, yeah, it's more of a snapshot. There are some tools like the En-ROADS tool out of MIT that is dynamic and you can kind of test different things. That is not the forecasting we did here.
Great. Yeah. I appreciate that. Thank you. And questions, Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then to Representative Knuth, former Representative Knuth. Just kind of looking at some of your presentation here, we have that new greenhouse gas forecasting slide where it's kind of got the graph with the current policy scenario, the potential policy pathway scenario, and the net zero scenario. So the net zero scenario, which that explains what 2040 is, and then the current policy, so if nothing changes. So does that separation between the two, in your recognition, essentially that the 2040 isn't going to work, or what is that, like, what's that separation represent?
Yeah,
Ms. Knuth.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Sudzinski. So the 100% clean energy by 2040 is specifically the electricity sector. So the net zero for the entire economy goes well beyond the electricity sector. So the current policy scenario assumes that we meet current law, which it includes 100% clean electricity by 2040. But our statutory goals of carbon neutrality economy-wide go across all the sectors. And so the potential policies pathways, it has significant emissions reductions in all the sectors, as well as significant carbon sequestration or storage that would be required to achieve net zero. So 100% clean energy by 2040 is state law, and we assume it will happen. There's a lot of work to make it happen, but the modeling assumes it happens. And the net zero goes to the whole economy and getting carbon neutrality across the whole
economy. And it looks like Mr. Kolash might
want to add. And Madam Chair, I want to add to that response also that the 2040 law is built in to the current policies and considered in the net zero scenario. And it is the foundation for achieving emission reductions in all other sectors. We will need that clean electricity that's from the 2040 law to then reduce emissions in the building sector, the transportation sector, the industrial sector as well.
Representative Sudzinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if I understand you correctly, you're trying to use the net zero scenario, which would be a goal, but you leverage the current carbon-free by 2040 law to leverage all other aspects of the economy other than just electrical generation.
Madam Chair and Chair Sudzinski, yes, that is the core of what that forecasting is based on. We have the need for the 100% clean electricity, and that is absolutely necessary for emission reductions in nearly all of the other sectors, that we have that zero emission electricity so that we can move away from fossil fuel use in those other sectors, leveraging the electricity, whether it's for direct use particularly in the heating side for industrial processes for residential buildings, or in the production of other fuels that can be stored or other storage of energy that can be used for the heating, and some of that storage being with like hydrogen or other fuels.
And maybe can I just even say in a broader sense, in a lot of ways, in talking about buildings or vehicles, it's electrification and then cleaning up the electric grid. Mm-hmm. So, Representative Sudzinski.
Thank you. So, thank you, Madam Chair. So, just kind of guessing, kind of some of the conversation. Obviously, I wasn't in the room. And probably a little bit on the slow side in general. But would you say that the group would be advocating for, you know, from a residential side, what were those conversations like? Like, what do they think would fix that? So when it comes to, like, natural gas or firewood, or is that the kind of conversations that are happening in replacing those types of things, or gas stoves, for instance?
Ms. Knuth?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Sudzinski. I want to clarify, the forecasting was less an exercise in advocating for specific policies, but trying to explore and better understand what would be needed to achieve the emissions reduction goals that are in state statute. And one of the things we did find is, and I have this graph I can follow up with, we will use more electricity. As Chair Akam said very clearly, more efficiency, electrification, and then getting the electric sector clean. So the kinds of things that would be included there, first, efficiency, making sure we're weatherizing more homes. That's really important from an equity perspective and actually a comfort and health and resilience perspective. There's efficiency around building envelopes, commercial buildings, industrial sector, and then, yes, electrifying heat sources where it makes financial sense. And then in some cases, it might be doing geothermal, mm-hmm. network geothermal, thermal energy networks, the district energy system, like in St. Paul. We weren't able to get into like designing the specific system that would do this, but rather a suite of policies of technologies. We tried to be kind of technology agnostic, but just wanted to give you a sense of some of the technologies that could help achieve that clean heat part of what we modeled.
Representative Sudzinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just kind of, you know, obviously we're kind of talking kind of pie in the sky, talking about kind of goals, which are, you know, not really, you know, like, do you think the conversations maybe were tilting towards, you know, what the state might start wanting to mandate versus to reach those goals, and kind of from a policy infrastructure position, where the department, where the governor, where the legislature should potentially go when it comes to mandates in these particular areas that would be beneficial to reaching those goals?
Mr. Kolesch?
Madam Chair, we use the modeling, again, as a guidepost to tell us where we should be going. It's not looking for any of a policy proposals or mandates. We were looking at the kinds of activities and the kinds of policies that were adopted through various means in other states or other countries to look at how they would impact emissions in Minnesota based on what emissions looks like. So it is a directionality focused. It is not laying out particular proposals from the governor, from the Department of Commerce, from the PCA. It's showing what is possible based on what other states and other countries are doing in these areas to reduce emissions.
Representative Swazinski.
And just kind of to finish up, did, you know, so I know you've got it, have done a lot of modeling. Appreciate that. Did you guys kind of model, like, let's say the current policy scenario, the potential policy scenario, and the net policy scenario goal? If those things were all reached in 20 years or 25 years, so we, you know, no longer were using natural gas, we were no longer burning firewood or any of these other things, kind of, you know, what could we expect the environment to be different than it is today if Minnesota on its own in the Midwest, you know, 100% reaches these goals? Like, would we expect it to get colder, or we expect it to not rain as much, or less tornadoes? Like, what could we almost guarantee would happen, like, yeah, assuming that Minnesota does this kind of as an island or whatever?
Ms. Knuth.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Swazinski. So I think two parts of that question. Minnesota is part of a massive global economy, so we need to reduce the avoid the worst impacts of climate change. I think When the statutory goals were adopted, that doing Minnesota's part of that international collective effort. But I think very specifically, one of the really interesting things about this forecasting is we look specifically at a suite of potential policies, again, for learning, for helping us better understand the potential path forward to get closer to our goals. So we were able to model specific health benefits or impacts, as well as economic impacts. And based on the air pollution reductions alone from these actions, we would save an estimated $1.17 billion to $2.28 billion in total health benefits, which would be 86 to 173 fewer early deaths, 66,400 fewer asthma symptom days, 12,000 fewer work days lost, as well as 14,100 fewer school days lost. So that's directly from the air pollution, like PM2.5 or SOX, or not the stuff that is in the greenhouse gases, so things that make it harder to breathe. So those are direct benefits that we modeled would come from. Again, this is the potential policy pathways, because that was more of a bottom-up kind of figuring out a suite of policies that other states have done. And then we found, roughly speaking, the economic growth would be about just as strong. You would be investing in different things, so you would shift what the investments were in, but we'd still have strong economic and job growth with the potential policies pathway scenario.
Next on the list is Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the testimony. It's really one of the best overviews I've seen in a long time. My question, I have a couple questions. Does your organization, the Climate Action Council with the MPCA, do you advise us on your policy suggestions, or do you just take the reports, run it through your models, and say, here's what you have with current model or our policy? Do you recommend policy to us to help us achieve our goals?
Mr. Kolesch.
Madam Chair, Representative Baker, we do that through the normal policy process that we have with the governor, where the individual agencies through the climate change subcabinet, we will be looking at what kinds of policies are possible, which ones will make sense for Minnesota and at what rates. And then we will work together to identify which policies will move forward through the regular process. That's the typical way that we would be advising on the legislature. We do are open to additional conversations, the information of the modeling and the forecasting, and there are also addendums which have actions identified in them, which would be eligible for and consideration for whether or not that comes from the administration or that comes from the legislative branch. We've used these tools to identify where we think we can get the either the most emission reductions, the greatest building of resiliency, addressing equity in the climate actions that we have, and then also making sure we're building a clean economy for Minnesota.
Representative Baker, did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, I have a couple follow-ups, Madam Chair.
You bet.
And to that, do you recommend that we get moving on a nuclear moratorium lift so we can have more conversations about how that could affect the modeling down the road? What is your opinion to us on that?
Mr. Kolesch.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Baker. That would be a question directly best answered by Department of Commerce, but I have talked with Department of Commerce about that, and certainly in our forecasting, we included the continued operation of the nuclear plants as going forward, and that any nuclear moratorium lifting would be at the choice of the legislature, and any challenges that come with nuclear is going to be the costs. And so that would go through the Public Utilities Commission as far as making sure that those costs are appropriate and necessary for the process, and that the Department of Commerce is working on a study for how particular modular reactors could work in Minnesota. So we don't have, as the PCA, we're not taking a position on that specifically, but we do understand that nuclear is seen in other states as well as an opportunity for zero emission electricity, and that would be for broader discussion with the legislature and with the administration.
Thank you.
And Representative Baker.
Final, yeah. I want to maybe again give a heads up to our brand new members that are here in the committee today. This is one of the most important slide presentations we're going to see in order for us to reach our 2040 goal that was put in 3 years ago. We will never get there if we don't have nuclear part of this conversation, new nuclear, because we don't have the ability to do that with the growth in industrial predictions. We are going to need more power in the future, clean baseload power. We aren't going to be able to do it with solar and wind and other things that are still coming along very nicely. I just want to make sure we have allowed 3 years to go by when 2040 was passed. And I know there's a lot of things around that conversation with our tribal partners and all those other things. But what we could still be doing, though, is having this moratorium be lifted so we can have the conversations and still work on our partnerships with our citizens around Minnesota, our tribal units, because 3 years has gone by. The need is getting there. The 2040 deadline is coming up, and you keep using words like, we keep pushing for 100%, dot, dot, dot. We need to move faster. You're spot on. I like this a lot. But, and again, we don't know what the federal government's going to do. Are they going to slow things down on the federal side to get clean air? We don't know. But what we can control here in Minnesota is the ability to lift the moratorium and start having the companies and the investors that might want to look at this in the future more time to better plan, to better scheme out what it looks like and put in the modeling outcomes of what this will look like. If we just sit on our hands and not do something, every year that goes by is another year of planning and forecasting. Again, this has been one of the best climate action plans going forward that I can see. We don't have a plan to get rid of all of our fossil fuels. It's not possible at this point, in my opinion. I don't see it happening, but I see a lot of things are going in the right direction with, better planting and better vehicles, emissions. A lot of good things are happening, but we're never going to get our goal if we don't get serious about the discussion about nuclear. We don't have to have all the answers to talk about allowing that discussion to happen. Because it's going to be, if we all of a sudden did, and we continue to work with our partners, there's going to be so many more decisions to make in this committee, in the future legislators, that will say yes or no to nuclear if that's part of the plan going forward. This is not by any means the end of it, because again, we aren't going to get there, and I'm concerned about economic development. I'm concerned about industrial baseload power. I'm going to need a lot of it if we want to work on getting really great jobs, really good companies. They need power that they can count on. And it starts with earlier planning. So members, I just can't not express to you all enough. We need to get moving on this year for sure, just so we can start having these conversations with the planning, because I want to see your models with that as a possibility. That's, I think, what we're missing here. And with that, Madam Chair, that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Baker. Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Kolosh, Ms. Kanu, thank you so much for being here. Some questions and some comments. So really like digging more into the natural and working lands side of this. How are you going to be measuring progress in that area? I know that's a challenging area. What kind of things are you trying to do to measure more progress? And then I also like seeing peatlands in there. Can you talk about the potential for peatlands? And my understanding is they're one of the strongest carbon sinks out there. Like, are you looking at how can we supercharge that stuff?
Ms. Knuth.
Yeah. Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Kraft. For the natural and working lands and across both the land use conversion, and the agricultural side, we have that as a strong portion of our now annual emissions. We're going to try to calculate this on an emission basis. It's also part of our every 2 year legislative report. It is in there, and we continue to work with stakeholders, work across the climate change subcabinet to identify what are the potential policy levers that are already in place that we can continue to amplify and move forward with. That for agricultural lands primarily fits within working with Department of Agriculture, their climate smart agricultural practices, both with federal funding and with state funding, to move that forward, identify ways that we can reduce the emissions that are coming from the application of nitrogen fertilizers with various technologies, identifying research that's happening at the University of Minnesota and other universities within the state. And we track that, and we have various tools, and we're working with a number of stakeholders in all of those areas about how are we going to continue to track the emissions, also the carbon storage. And we have started to add the peatlands into our land use and land conversion side. We have funding for that, both at state and federal level. It's part of a large federal grant that we have for the restoration of peatlands that were degraded due to attempted uses for agricultural purposes. So we're moving forward on that. We're going to continue to measure and monitor that. And we also have the work that needs to be done, and this is primarily led out of Department of Natural Resources and Board of Water and Soil Resources, with the restoration of peatlands on both public lands and private lands. And how do we make that work forward? And the climate subcabinet also put together for the natural and working lands area a list of measures that we want to track. We brought all the relevant agencies together. We talked to stakeholders about these are the kinds of, they're more actions. They're not going to be the outcomes. They're not going to be the emission reduction, but they're, what we know is that they're part of the measurement chain of how many acres are we adding to various practices, and what's that change, because then that change is going to lead to the emission reductions in the future.
Representative Kraft. Oh, I'm so sorry. Thanks.
Sorry. No, Madam Chair and Representative Kraft, just two quick things. I think in the forecasting document, we had we forecasted the natural and working lands with a little bit of a different approach, because it's not covered very well in the model that we selected. And so there's some, I think, if you're interested in how climate change will impact natural systems and the need to focus, like double down really, on keeping them healthy, there's some really, I think, eye-opening information in that forecasting document. Happy to share that with you and follow up if you have questions, or with the person who actually did that modeling on my team. And then just to hit very quickly, like I think $12 million from the federal government with the climate pollution reduction grant that we still are operating both through DNR, Board of Water and Soil Resources, and then with direct grants to several tribes that are in areas with peatland ecosystems.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I've just got some comments. So thank you. I think this was an excellent presentation. I absolutely agree with Representative Baker, and I appreciate the urgency you're bringing to the discussion. I certainly feel that on climate change from many different levels, both from both from an economic perspective. I think there's tremendous economic opportunity in how we move forward, and in just a moral perspective for our kids and grandkids. You know, it's easy to look at graphs and numbers and stuff like that, but what it represents and the fact that we are not on track. We are not on track to a science-derived goal of getting to net zero emissions by 2050. Climate change is going to get worse. And the people that are going to feel those impacts are the ones that have least caused it, and they're going to be our kids and our grandkids. And I don't know about you, but I want a livable, equitable, and sustainable future for my kids and my grandkids and for your kids and your grandkids. You know, there was a question of, you know, what it would look like, right? Well, I tell you, what it's looking like now is wildfires that are keeping us inside and our kids inside in the summer. It's looking like Rapidan Dam that just about got washed away. It's looking like floods putting farmers at risk. It's looking like home insurance rates going through the roof because it's harder and harder to deal with the impacts of climate change. It's looking like our infrastructures of our cities, stormwater being impacted because of the increased precipitation we're seeing and an increased freeze and thaw cycles. So what would it look like if just Minnesota did this? If we are an island and we are the only ones on the planet that addresses climate change? Well, in that case, the things, the policies that we're talking about, we'd have far less air pollution here. There would be far less asthma. We'd have cleaner water. We'd have healthier food because the soil would be healthier and the food grown in it would be healthier. We'd have an economy that's more insulated from the wild swings of fossil fuel prices because it would be based on energy that we were generating in Minnesota ourselves. We'd have more comfortable homes and buildings. We'd have more cost-effective homes. We'd have more forests and more peatlands. That's what it would look like if we were an island. Now, we are not an island, right? If we are the only ones that do this, I shudder to think about the impact that it will have on the habitat that our kids and grandkids are going to have to live in. But I don't think that's the case. I'm hopeful. I think many things are happening in many other communities, in many other states, in many other countries. And Minnesota, we can lead here. It should not be okay to any of us that we are behind that goal. And we can do policies here, thoughtful policies to get us on track there that make the future healthier for all of us and make our economy stronger. So, Chair Swedzinski, that's the kind of vision I want to go for. Whether or not we're an island, we will be far better off when we deal with the data that these folks are bringing to us and we deal with it in the right way. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kraft. We've got three more people to ask questions, and so just want to make sure people are keeping an eye on the tap. We've got about 8 minutes. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to circle back on the early slide you had about the emissions by sector and talk about agriculture again. You mentioned the two leading causes of emissions were fertilizer and animal agriculture. And I get the fertilizer piece because a lot of the fertilizer we use today is manufactured halfway around the world. It's shipped over here up the Gulf, and we are at the end of the pipeline. But I would remind members that we're working on a bill and looking for funding that would have a green fertilizer plant right here in Minnesota of a commercial size scale, and could provide enough nitrogen fertilizer for a couple hundred thousand acres. And that would be a big step forward in terms of the reduced emissions by fertilizer. But I'd like to talk for a second about animal agriculture. Sometimes I think that gets kind of a bum rap. And again, kind of going back to the use of fertilizer, animal manure is very valuable. And when that can replace commercial fertilizer, I've seen fields that produce corn, for example, and the carbon intensity score when they use manure fertilizer decreases dramatically. Are you giving enough credit to those types of things that animal agriculture can do on a positive side in terms of lowering those carbon scores for other things?
Ms. Knuth or Mr. Kolesh?
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. I have it on this computer, but not this one. We have a graphic that I would love to share with the chair and the committee that basically in the kind of the big things now part shows the scale of both emissions of greenhouse gases going into the atmosphere and being sequestered, because agriculture does have really important sequestration components and forest lands, obviously. Roughly speaking, animal agriculture is both the enteric fermentation, which is a fancy word of saying cow burps, and then manure management. Yet there are better, there are ways to manage manure where it is used as a very valuable input into agriculture. And so there's a whole bunch of complexity represented in that manure management category, but it does recognize that there are different ways of managing. And on the fertilizer side, some of it is from the actual production of fertilizer, which may or may not happen in the state, and a good chunk of it is also from the application of fertilizer, and then the nitrous oxide coming off of the fields is an important part of the overall greenhouse gas emissions in the agriculture sector.
Representative Anderson. Next, we have Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I found it really interesting. I have to go very, very fast, though, so I apologize. I've got two questions. One was about how do the cuts from the federal government, how is that going to impact that little graph that shows us going down, right? Like, what would that look like if we reassess in 4 years, assuming that the cuts stay in place? And then the second question was, you mentioned climate adaptation that needs to be done. I was wondering if you have any details about where that primarily is and what the cost of it is to do that correctly.
Ms. Knuth.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. Again, if you in the technical support document, and happy to show you where specifically after, essentially the current policies before and after the federal policy changes with the investments and then the changes in the Clean Air Act, it will be more difficult for Minnesota and more expensive for Minnesota to achieve its greenhouse gas emission reduction statutory goals. So happy to go into some of the details, but that's high level. In terms of the resilience and the adaptation actions, stay tuned for a report that we will be coming with that you all funded a couple of years ago. I think you carried the bill, so you're well aware. That report will talk about the overall numbers. It doesn't go into, like, specific location. This is what needs to happen in this community. But it will be a really useful piece of information. And then we do have processes of prioritization within MPCA, within several other agencies, with MnDOT has a resilience improvement plan. So there's places literally looking at infrastructure on the ground. And we at MPCA, through the $100 million Resilient Communities Grant Program, has funded dozens of communities to do resilience planning, where local communities at that scale, that's where you can really get into the details of how big does this culvert need to be? How much higher does this road need to be? Those sorts of questions that are just really very difficult and don't make the most sense at the state level. So we have some of that information at the more granular level, and not for the whole state, but in specific areas.
And Madam Chair, if I can add, from our Resilient Communities grants, what we're seeing, substantial need from local governments for their stormwater management and their infrastructure, their wastewater infrastructure. We hear from Department of Commerce on the grid infrastructure, and then the Department of Transportation on the transportation infrastructure as well.
And last question to Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question has to do with your model and just the forecasting part. I think you referred to it as a 100-page document that talks about forecasting. Do you cite the data that you use? Okay, so for each one, whether it's the data emissions versus the CO2 that you're accomplishing, would that be part of your compelling data?
Ms. Knuth.
Madam Chair and Representative, so we use a very long developed model called the GCAM model, but has a lot of different inputs. So that is documented. And if you want to go even further documentation, you could look at that model specifically. On the natural and working lands side, we go through all the assumptions. Modeling is basically coming to a set of agreed assumptions and then figuring out what kind of things you could expect from that. So we have really significant documentation on the methods used, the model used, as well as the various assumptions that needed to go into it to make the model work.
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, thank you. So I'm just curious, is there any data out there, research, that actually shows you what you should expect the CO2 to look like?
Chairman, I'm not sure what you are looking for here, but certainly what we would see is the model is showing just the CO2 emissions that come from Minnesota and the activities, and then that would have to be put into a global model about what the actual CO2 in the atmosphere is, and then that leads to other additional models that tell us what to expect from the climate response, particularly for extreme weather and other impacts.
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, sorry, my question wasn't very clear. Just on CO2 expectation-wise, I mean, we must have a goal. So what do you expect? Is there compelling documents that say this is what we expect with our plan, with our goal? Are there documents that can show that? I'd love to have that to look at.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm going back, sorry to go through so quickly. So we do have goals in state statute of 30% reduction by 2025 and 50% reduction by 2030 and carbon neutrality, so net zero, because carbon dioxide is held in natural systems, in trees, in soil, and then there's also the carbon dioxide and other of the many greenhouse gas emissions going into the atmosphere. So this is essentially the take-home slide of the forecasting, showing with current policy we would get to approximately approximately 39% reduction in overall carbon dioxide or greenhouse gases, which are turned into carbon dioxide equivalents, so basically measured as the equivalent of carbon dioxide. And if we pursued a suite of potential policy pathways that are more ambitious than what we currently are doing, a 77% reduction, and then the net zero scenario just forces the model to find the most cost-effective way, which includes significant emission storage and sequestration as well. So it's not a super one sentence answer, but hopefully that helps with what you're going for.
Yeah, and Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah. If there is something that was compelling that you could show us, that would be really helpful. With regard to, I know we can't necessarily assume that the world's efforts are going to accomplish, but what would the goal of it be if we were to make it a global change? What are we looking for? I think that would be great to see. If it's out there, I'd love to see it, and I really would love to be able to look at the source and cite the data.
Yeah. Madam Chair, the results we're looking at is driving the net zero is the work of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, that they do assessments every 4 years and look at the data, and they have identified reducing the temperature change to 1.5 degrees Celsius and 2 degrees Celsius. We've already moved through 1.5 degrees, so minimizing temperature increase to 2.2 degrees Celsius, and then that can be broken down into then what countries need to reduce their emissions to bring that, and really it does outline getting to a net zero by 2050 limits us to a 2 degree Celsius increase future, which then can minimize or head off many of the negative effects of climate change that Representative Kraft identified.
And it looks like we may have to have you back, because this has been a great conversation. Thank you all. We're going to have to take it offline, Representative. We're over time. Can we get a link to the report?
Wonderful.
Let's get that up to all members.
Framework, if you
want. Yeah. Thank you. And with that, we are adjourned.